Thank you very much for that nice introduction. So it's a pleasure for me to be here. I have actually never been to this campus, so I'm a little overwhelmed. It's a huge, I don't know how you guys find your ways around. It seems like a many, many, many buildings and stuff, but it's very nice to be here. And, you know, it's always nice to get an invitation, but there's one invitation in my mind that really sticks out a lot, and that was maybe 4 years ago, I got an email from the Vatican, and it's from some Monsignor, and it said, we'd like to appoint you to this Pontifical Academy for Life, and you'll have a chance for an audience with Pope Francis. And I thought, wow, that's terrific. So I said back, of course, right away, yes, I'd love to do that. And I said, well, by the way, what kind of audience is it? Because some audiences with the Pope are the Pope and like 500 people, and you're in the back row, and you're like, see, some tiny figure in white way up there. And they said, no, no, this is a personal audience. Like, you get to shake the Pope's hand and talk to him a little bit. And I was like, wow, okay, that's great. So I thought, what am I going to say to the Pope, right? I mean, imagine you have a chance to meet the Pope and talk to him a little bit. What am I going to say? And I thought, well, I want to say something very meaningful and maybe start a little conversation, right? So I thought for a while, I thought, okay, what I'll say is, Holy Father, would you please pray for my family and my university? And I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll say, well, tell me about your family or what university are you from or whatever, and I'll have a chance to, you know, have a little meaningful conversation with him. And then I thought, okay, well, what? I don't speak Italian, and I don't speak Spanish. So I thought, well, what language should I use? And, you know, I heard he doesn't really speak English that well, so I can't speak English. So he lived in Germany for 2 years, and then I lived in Germany for 2 years also. So I thought, okay, I'll say it in German, right? So then we'll have a common language. Great. So the big moment comes, and there's this kind of line. Imagine like a communion line with a bunch of people, and you get up in the front, and the person right in front of me is talking to the Pope. Shakes hands, they're talking, it's going great, and they have this little conversation, and then he moves to the side, and then my turn. So there I walk up, and there is a Pope right in front of me. I think, God, first thing I thought is, he looks just like his picture. It's like, okay. And so I reach out my hand, and I say in English, nice to meet you. That was it. Forgot the whole thing. Anyway, so that didn't work out so well, but hopefully today will work out. A little bit better. Today I want to talk to you about psychology and Christianity and the relationship between those two things. And when I was at the University of Notre Dame, I was went to see a psychologist. And basically, there was no huge trauma, but basically, it was sort of hard. Because I don't know if you've ever been to graduate school, but in graduate school, it's very stressful. You feel like people are always evaluating you, and you worry about getting kicked out of the program and stuff. And also, I was married and I had 3 kids, and I was only making $10,000 a year. So imagine, in a family of 5 living at $10,000 a year, you know, it was challenging. So anyway, so my friend says, hey, you should go talk to a psychologist. Oh, all right. So I go into the psychologist, we have our first meeting, and yeah, it seemed to go okay. And then I came in the next week for the second meeting, and he said to me, you know, Chris, there are two kinds of people that psychology is completely worthless for. I said, really? Oh, what's that? He said, well, the first are hardcore addicts. You know, like if you're addicted to meth or you're addicted to crack or whatever, psychological counseling just is not going to work at all. I said, okay. And he said, well, what's the other group? Intellectuals like you. So then, all right, well, I guess this was our last meeting. But that was it. That was the end of our meeting. And I never had much to do with psychology after that, because I thought, well, I guess I'm just hopeless and it's not going to ever work for me. Let me tell you another story. When I was, I got this job opportunity to move to Washington, D.C., and the job was like this wonderful dream job, director of the honors program at Catholic U, and it came with a 40% raise. So, you know, I think if your job all of a sudden say, hey, I'll pay you 40% more to do your job, that's pretty good. So I moved out to Washington, D.C., and it was better than I thought. Like, I just loved my colleagues, I had this completely terrific parish. It was just absolutely wonderful. And anyway, you think, oh, great, this must be really wonderful. But there was one huge problem. My wife hated it, right? Hated Washington, D.C. So we had a big discussion for, like, 6 months, nonstop. You know, should we stay here? Should we go back? back and forth, and things were not looking good. So I thought, okay, well, I've got to really pray that God will make my wife like Washington, D.C. So that's what I did. I started praying. No change at all. If anything, things got a little worse. She said, all right, let's not worry. So then I thought, okay, I should pretend like it's Lent. And I should sacrifice and pray and sacrifice this will, and then she'll, you know, like to. And anyway, so I did that for a while, and no change at all. Okay. So I thought, I better help God out a little bit. So I went to my wife one day and I said, honey, I just want to let you know, I've been really praying for you and offering sacrifice. And I hope, you know, that God will make it so that you really like being here in Washington. And she said, well, that's very interesting. She said, have you asked God what God wants? And I thought, oh, no, I haven't done that. So, and I was afraid to do that. I didn't want to know what God wants. If God wants me to move back to Los Angeles, I just didn't even want to know that, right? But, you know, after 2 or 3 weeks or whatever, I thought, well, you know, God does know everything, right? And he is all loving. And, well, maybe I should check in and kind of consult with God just to kind of see, get a sense, maybe. Anyway, so I did finally got the courage to ask God what God wanted. And then I came to the conviction very quickly that what God wanted is for us to go back to Los Angeles. So that's what we did. Now, I would love to tell you that I came back to Los Angeles, and when I got here, I was a chipper, happy husband, and I was just like two thumbs up, everything's great, but that would be a lie. That wasn't true. I was very unhappy to come back. So, since I'm a scholar, what I did is I got on Google, and I said, how to be happier or something. Googled it up. Up comes the question. Up comes this thing I'd never heard of. Up came this field of psychology called positive psychology. Now, for most of the history of psychology, psychology is focused on things like depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, things like that. But about 20 years ago, there was a professor at the University of Pennsylvania named Martin Seligman. And Seligman became president of the American Psychological Association. And Seligman challenged all the psychologists. He said, look, we've been focusing on these negative things, and that's important. But there's a whole other side of the human experience that we have been ignoring. Right? We have not looked into how to be happier. We have not looked into how to overcome difficulties. That is to say, not just post-traumatic stress syndrome, but post-traumatic growth syndrome. Right? We haven't looked at learned optimism. We haven't explored all these things, and we need to do that. Right? If we're going to be balanced and have something to say about the whole of human experience, we can't just be only exclusively focusing on the negative. So Seligman challenged all the psychologists. And what they did is they, some of them, took up this challenge and said, you're right, we should look at these other things. And so that's what they did. And they began to investigate many, many different practices that some people said could boost happiness, right? And so they tested them in the way they test medications. You guys know about when they introduce a new medication, they do what are called double-blind studies. So for instance, let's say you guys were all in the study. Well, you know, some of you would receive the actual medication. You wouldn't know it. Some of you would actually receive just a placebo, right? Yeah, you wouldn't know you were receiving a placebo. And then they'd study a whole bunch of people and say, well, you know, what happened to their asthma or whatever, right? And then if the double-blind study works properly, it turns out, maybe, that the medication doesn't work at all, right? There's no difference between those who took the medication and those who had the placebo. Or maybe it turns out the medication works super well, right? And you say, okay, this is an effective medication. So what the positive psychology folks did is look at many different interventions that were claimed to boost happiness. And they tried to figure out through these double-blind studies which one of these interventions worked. So let me give you an example of one of the studies they came up with. They split university students into two groups. And to the first group, they said, we want you to go do something really fun, right? So go out and, like, go eat some ice cream or go to the movies or do something like that, really fun, right? And a second group of the university students, they said, we want you to do something that's serving others. Right? So maybe you guys can go to an old folks home and like visit with them and pray with them and kind of cheer them up. Maybe you could help kids learn how to read, like going to a school that's kind of a bad school, like, you know, help tutor them and help them read or something, right? Do something altruistic. And then come back and tell us, you know, what happened. And what happened was this. The first group of students who went out and did something fun, which was the movies, they said, hey, that was great. We had a great time. I thought that was a great movie. And you know, we had ice cream. That was really tasty. But basically, the kind of joy they got out of that positive emotion they had, they did get it, but then it basically went away quickly. Right? Like, think about eating ice cream. Right? When you're actually eating it, oh, it tastes really good. But, you know, really soon it's gone and that's the end of it. The people, however, that did service to others, they reported a boost in positive emotion, but the difference was that boost lasted a week, 2 weeks, sometimes even longer. So the researchers, and these are secular researchers, came to the conclusion that serving others, helping others, is a great way to boost positive emotion. Right? Now, as a Catholic, I found that kind of interesting, because as a Catholic, I've been told my whole life that part of a Christian way of life is to try to serve others and help them in some way, right? And each one of us can do that in a different way maybe, but that's part of living a Christian life, is serving others, the vulnerable, those that need help, etc. So that, well, that's kind of a weird coincidence. These are secular researchers that are basically confirming a Christian practice, right? These weren't Christians who did the research. Mostly they're agnostics, but I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. Well, then I read another study. And in this study, it recommended something called the three good things exercise. And this is something you guys can do today. So all you do is you think about your day, right, tonight. And you write down three sentences. And the sentences are about any three things that went well today. So maybe you write down, I had a nice lunch with my friend and the food was good. Right, so that's one thing. And maybe the second sentence is, I'm really grateful because I talked to my roommate who said she'd be happy to do my laundry for me or whatever. So that's sentence number two. And the third sentence would be, I'm grateful because the professor today canceled class, so I got to relax and go study something else, or go to the beach, or whatever you like to do. So that's all you do. Three, write down three good things. Okay? Now, if you do this, the research indicates that it alleviates mild to moderate depression in about 90% of people, right? If you do this over the course of 2 weeks. Now, why does it work? Well, it works because all of our lives, right, are a mixture of pleasant and unpleasant things, good and bad things. But the things that are unpleasant and bad naturally draw our attention, right? Just think about it, like when you have a finger that hurts or something. Right? I mean, of course, you think about that finger that hurts, not the other nine fingers that aren't hurting. So what does this exercise do? Well, if you do it every day for 2 weeks, what happens is you begin to notice and appreciate the good things that are actually in your life already, which you just kind of never really paid attention to. Right? I mean, it's not magic. Like, if I asked you every day, I want you to write down how many people were wearing black shoes. Right? I mean, once you start looking around people's shoes, you'd be like, well, okay, there's black shoes, there's black shoes. I mean, if you start, you know, looking for something, like black shoes, you're going to see those shoes a lot more often than if you're not looking for them at all. Right? So these gratitude exercises are a way of refocusing our attention on the realities of our life that are actually pretty good. Okay. Well, I started doing that, and that really did help me a lot. And then I thought to myself, well, you know, I've actually heard this before somewhere. Huh. And where I heard it before was a guy named St. Ignatius Loyola. He is the founder of the Jesuit order, the Society of Jesus, right, Pope Francis's order. And the Jesuit, the founder of the Jesuit order, St. Ignatius, he recommended to everyone who came to him for spiritual direction, he recommended to them once a day at least, think about the last, you know, 24 hours, and be grateful to God for any gifts God has given you in those last 24 hours. Right? In other words, he recommended doing what later people called the three good things exercise. And as I read more about gratitude, I realized that gratitude is unbelievably important. Gratitude literally saves lives. There was a study done of the days on which people commit suicide in the United States. And, you know, different days go up and down. But it turned out that the fewest number of people kill themselves in the United States on Thanksgiving Day. Right? On Thanksgiving Day, suicide rates go to their lowest of the whole year. Right? And why is that? Well, I think it's pretty obvious, right? On Thanksgiving Day, people in the United States, more than any other day, think about what they're grateful for, right? And they are, you know, thankful, and they turn, not, oh, I need this, I want that, I'm, my life's bad this way. They turn to gratitude for what's good. Now, we as Catholics are very lucky, because for us, Thanksgiving Day doesn't come around just once a year in November, right? We have Thanksgiving Day much more frequently, or we can, right? Why do I say that? Well, the Mass, or the Eucharist is just the Greek term for Thanksgiving, right? Every Mass, every Sunday, every day if you want, is an occasion for thanking God for all the blessings that are in our lives. And there are lots of blessings in our lives. In fact, I would bet $100 everyone in this room lives with greater comfort than anyone did, including kings, in the Middle Ages, than anyone did in the ancient world, including emperors. I mean, think about it. Think about the pharaoh, or whatever, in ancient Egypt, right? The pharaoh didn't have air conditioning, right? The pharaoh, when he got a cavity, did he go to the dentist and get Novocaine? And no. Pharaoh didn't have antibiotics. Pharaoh did have an iPhone. I'm guessing some of you have an iPhone. Pharaoh couldn't get in a plane and go across the world. Couldn't pick up a phone and call people across town. Right? All of us, right, are living with many things that really the royalty of ancient days didn't have. Right? But did I wake up this morning and be like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. I live in an amazing country. I've got Novocaine. I've got antibiotics. I've got, you know, a phone. I've got, I can get on a plane if I want. Of course I didn't do that, right? And I'm guessing you didn't either. But we could, right? We really do have a lot to be grateful for. A lot. And not just us in this room. That's true of people around the world. It used to be the case until about 100 years ago. It used to be the case that almost all human beings were extremely poor. Like so poor that they didn't have enough food. Like starving to death poor. 99% of people throughout all human history lived on less than $2 a day in inflation-adjusted dollars. Right? So imagine trying to live on $2 a day. I mean, you know how hungry you'd be? I assume you'd spend most of it on food. I mean, you would be completely famished. Right? For the last 100 years, the percentage of people that are extremely poor has been dropping. Right now, it's dropped all the way to about only 8%. And it's headed towards, by about the year 2032 or so, it's going to be zero if it keeps going at the rate it's going. So things on planet Earth are really getting much, 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 much better. But are we grateful? Do we even know that? Or do we think, oh, everything's going to hell in a handbasket? Is it worse than ever? No, things are not worse than ever. We have much to be grateful for, personally and as a human community, for sure. So, we have service to others, we have gratitude, and the next thing I learned in positive psychology is about the importance of forgiveness. Right? There's lots of studies in psychology about the benefits, the physical health benefits of forgiveness. Right? Lower blood pressure, less likelihood of getting a heart attack, less likelihood of getting ulcers, longer life, all kinds of things, lower stress as a result of forgiveness. Now, why is that? Because when you have unforgiveness, right? Let's say Mallory did something really horrible to me, and I'm like, I hate her. She's horrible. And what do? I think, I'm going to get her. You just wait. And I kind of, in my mind, I imagine, like, getting my revenge on her. And what am I doing? It's a little bit like I've got these burning hot coals, and I'm thinking, wait till I see her. Growing her face, I hate her so much, and they're all worked up, right? I'm in a kind of fight or flight physiology, right? I'm like this. I'm going to get them, oh, and you're really worked up, right? But think about it. If you're carrying around a bunch of burning hot coals, right, when you throw it in someone's face, you know, you're the one who's getting burned, right? You're the one who's hurting yourself. She may not even know that I'm mad at her. She may have no clue at all, right?
Yeah.
Did you know that?
No.
No, I didn't. It's a totally surprise. I'm curious. So what does the psychologist say? They say it's psychologically healthy, physically healthy, and emotionally healthy to forgive other people. Okay. Well, that's a great idea, isn't it? That's a really great idea. Huh. I think I heard that before somewhere too. Right? I'm trying to think. Who was it? There's some famous person from history that really emphasized forgiveness a lot. Right? For instance, he taught his followers this, when his followers said, teach us how to pray, Lord. He said, be our Father. And right in the middle of it is what? Forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Somebody asked him one time, Lord, how many times do I have to forgive my neighbor? Seven times? Well, that's a lot. Gosh, that's above and beyond the call of duty. Seven times. And he said in reply, no, 70 times seven. And you might think, well, once I get to 490, well, then I'm done. 491, I'm going to knock him out. Well, no. 70 times seven is the symbolic way of saying infinitely. Right? He wasn't literally talking about a particular number. It's a way of saying, you know, without limit. Now, did Jesus just talk about forgiveness? No, no. Think about Jesus when he was on the cross. When you're on the cross, you are dying, typically, not of losing blood, but of asphyxiation. That is to say, you can't breathe. And so what happens, basically, is in order to breathe, you need to push yourself up. But in order to push yourself up, it takes a lot of energy and effort and stuff. So eventually, you just get really tired, and then you die from not being able to get sufficient lungs or oxygen in your lungs. Now, what this means is anything someone says when they're up on a cross is got to be extremely important, right? Because you're not going to bother using your breath unless it really matters, right? So what does he do on the cross? Well, he makes sure his mother's taken care of. And you can see that. If you were dying, wouldn't you want your mother to be taken care of? Right? So he does that. Right? But what else does he do? He says, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. Okay. Wonderful, unbelievable example of forgiveness. And imagine forgiving people as they are killing you. You're in the middle of getting killed, right? And you forgive. So Jesus literally could not be more clear about the importance of forgiveness, right? And here I find the secular psychologist saying, hey, this is super important to do, right? See a little pattern developing? You have, in other words, independent, empirical evidence supporting central Christian practices. I could do the same thing talking about prayer. Right? Independent, empirical evidence of the benefits of that. I could talk about religious practice in terms of going to church. Lots of studies showing that people who go to church are happier, are healthier, have better social relationships. And this is not just a matter of belief. In other words, we're not talking about, oh, I was baptized Catholic and I never go to Mass anymore. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about people actually going to church. Right? Lots and lots of benefits. And you might wonder, well, why is that? Well, one explanation would be, if you go to church, is it likely that you're going to hear messages about forgiveness? Well, if you go to Catholic churches, now I've never been to Satanist church. Satanism maybe is a whole different thing. They tell you, don't forgive your neighbor, don't serve anyone, be ungrateful. I've never been to one. But at least in a Catholic service, right? Every service emphasizes forgiveness. Right? Because at every Mass, right in the middle, is Our Father. Right? I don't think you could get out of there without gratitude, or at least an injunction of gratitude. We think about the last words of every single Mass are always the same. Right? Thanks be to God. Those are the last words of every Mass. Why is that? Well, I think the church wants us to walk out of there with that ringing in our ears, right? Gratitude. And then, of course, the emphasis on loving your neighbor and loving God. Completely bread and butter. So, you could have all this, right, without any religious practice. Let's say you could have gratitude. I mean, couldn't you be an atheist who's grateful to people? You could, certainly. Couldn't you be an atheist who serves your neighbor? You could do that, certainly. Couldn't you be an atheist who forgives others? You could do that too, right? So what does being Christian add on top of what you could get just as a secular positive psychology person? Well, I think Christianity does add quite a bit on top of what you would find in just a pure positive psychology sort of mode. One of the things that Christianity adds is an answer to the biggest problem in human life. which is death. Death is something that overshadows all human life and is going to take away all human life. And from a secular perspective, death is utter annihilation. Right? When you die, that is completely it for you. And everyone you know is going to die, so that's completely the end for them. And that is something that limits the meaning that we can have. Because whatever we do in this life, whether we're the second Mother Teresa and make everything in the world way better, whether we're the second Hitler making everything way worse, whatever we do, right, we're going to die. And those that we help or harm, they're going to die. And in the end, it's just not going to matter. Right? Because Mother Teresa and Hitler are very famous right now. But, you know, in the ancient world, there was a Mother Teresa and a Hitler, you know, 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago. And maybe if you're studying history, you might know about who these people are. But at some point, you know, who knows, 1,000 years from now, Hitler, Mother Teresa, these are the little mentions in, oh, you know, there's a 20th century, and there's some wars, and there was this bad guy Hitler, and a good woman named Mother Teresa, and it's going to be, no one's going to know about them. And then, of course, eventually, the sun is going to turn into a red giant and obliterate the earth, and all the history books will be gone, and all the human beings on earth will be incinerated, and that'll be the end of it, right? But if Christianity is true, death is not the final word. If Christianity is true, there is a life after this life. And what that means is that what we do in this life has eternal significance. The good that we do is not totally lost. And therefore, what we do really matters. It's deeply meaningful now and also in the future. A second thing that Christian faith and practice gives that secular psychology can't is forgiveness of sins. The fact is, everyone, all honest people, including atheists, agnostics, whoever, realize that they fall short of who they ought to be. There's no one out there, honest person, that is. There's no honest person out there who says, I'm perfect. I wake up, I'm always doing the right thing. All day long, I'm just absolutely perfect. I go to sleep at the perfect time. Everything's great. I'm just absolutely perfect. Right? I mean, maybe some people say that, but I think if they have any measure of self-evaluation that's honest, they have to say, well, I'm not perfect. Right? So we all fail. One way to think about it is, if the goal of human life is love, we all fall short of loving perfectly. Loving God perfectly, loving our neighbor perfectly, we even fail loving ourselves perfectly. Right? You know, many people fail even to take their medication, right? In fact, there are studies that show people that have pets, they're more likely to get their pets, the medication for the pets, than they're to take their own medication. Right? So we all fail in terms of love. Now, what is the answer of secular psychology for guilt? That is to say, guilt as the objective failure that we have. Well, secular psychology can do something about feelings of guilt. Right? In other words, they might alleviate those feelings. But guilt and feelings of guilt are two separate things. Right? In other words, you can objectively fail to love properly and not feel guilty. Right? And so what does secular psychology have to do about guilt itself? Not feelings of guilt, they can help with that, but guilt. Well, they don't have any answer for that. Right? Again, Christian faith and practice does. Right? There's such a thing as forgiveness of sins. And we as Catholics are so incredibly lucky because we have a way of receiving forgiveness for sins. You might think of it like this. All human beings make garbage, right? You can't help it. You eat a banana, you got the banana peel left over, right? Just as all human beings do things that are failures in love. Now, when you make garbage, right, you can put it in the corner, and that's not a big deal at first. But if you keep making garbage, which we do inevitably, and put more garbage in the corner, and more garbage, and it piles up, and it piles up, and piles up. Well, probably after a week, it's not too bad. But if you just let it keep on piling up, right, after a month, after 6 months, it's going to be awful. It's going to stink. It's going to be just terrible, right? And so what do smart people do? Well, smart people take out the garbage, right? Once a week, every other week, they take it out. They get rid of it. And we as Catholics are so lucky because we have a way of getting rid of the garbage in our lives. Right? We do. It's called confession. Right? Every single Saturday in almost every church in the world, 3 o'clock usually, something like that, 4 o'clock, there's confession. And when you have garbage in your life, which almost all of us do, at least to some degree, we can go and get rid of it. We don't have to smell it. We don't have to think about it. It doesn't have to clutter things up. We don't have to carry it around with us. What a huge blessing that is. Huge, huge, huge blessing to get rid of the garbage, to get rid of the guilt, to move forward. The third thing that Christian faith and practice offers that secular psychology can't is God. Secular psychology, by its nature, is neutral with respect to God. Yes, there are some atheist psychologists like Sigmund Freud, and there's some Christian psychologists like Robert Emmons, but as a method, psychology is neutral with respect to religious beliefs, right? Whether God exists or doesn't exist. And so it just doesn't say anything about that. It would be a little bit like a metal detector. Metal detectors just detect metal. They're neutral with respect to the existence of wooden objects, right? So if you get a metal detector at the beach and you're looking for your lost ring or something, it's going to be able to detect the metal. If your ring was made of wood, well, it's not going to be able to detect that. It doesn't say it's not there or that it is there. It just is. It just doesn't say anything about that because it's a metal detector. So psychology, insofar as it's empirical psychology, only detects things that are empirically verifiable. Things that have a shape, say, or a weight. But there are some things that don't have a shape or a weight. Like, think of weight, for example. Not everything that exists has a weight. Right? Well, like, for instance, what's the weight of the number 5? Does it weigh 3 pounds? Is it 3.5 pounds? Well, the number 5 doesn't weigh any particular pounds. Right? What's the weight of the color yellow? How much does it weigh? Well, it doesn't weigh any. It doesn't have any weight. Shakespeare's sonnet 18. How much is that weigh? Again, it doesn't have a weight. So lots of things do have a weight, and you can empirically verify its weight, but there are lots of other things that don't have a weight, including God. Why doesn't God have a weight? Well, because God, at least if Aquinas is right, doesn't have a physical body. If you don't have a physical body, you don't have any physical weight. Right? Okay. So why does God matter for happiness? Well, God matters for happiness on the supposition that what human beings want in part in life is love. And I think there's good philosophical reasons for thinking that we want love. A famous study done by at Harvard University called the Grant Study started with college students like you. And it studied them every year all the way through their lives. And some of them died at like 95. And the study was meant to try to figure out, well, what is it that's going to make for a flourishing, good human life? And they said this for years, decades, and decades, right? And at the end of this huge study, they asked the lead researcher, well, what is it that you found? What's really going to lead to a great human life? And the lead researcher said, happiness is love, full stop. Basically, they found that those people who have love in their life, loving family connections, loving friendships, loving God, those people have good lives. And other people, even if they were really rich, really powerful, really famous, they went to Harvard after all, they're probably rich, powerful, famous. They didn't have good lives. In fact, they often died young. So, as human beings, we crave love. But isn't it true that no matter how rich our friendships are, no matter how rich a marriage can be, or a relationship with family and friends, no one can love us perfectly, and we don't love anyone perfectly in return. All human loves are, to a degree, imperfect. So we want a perfect love, but we can't find that here below. And isn't it true also that we want things that are good? And yet, every good we encounter here below is an imperfect kind of good. And we want truth. Think about what happens when you lose your cell phone, right? Do you like that? You're like, cool, I lost my cell phone, I don't care. I'm guessing no, right? I'm guessing if you lose your cell phone, you freak out, right? Why do you freak out? Well, because your cell phone is an access to the truth, right? The truth about who's texting you. The truth about who's calling you. The truth about how do I get from this location to that location. All kinds of truths you're deprived of if you lose your cell phone, right? And you don't like that because you want the truth, right? But every truth that you can get through your cell phone is partial, fragmentary, and sometimes things you get through your cell phone aren't even true. They're fake news or whatever. Right? So, we want perfect love, we want perfect goodness, we want perfect truth, but we can never find those here below. So, unless our desires are in vain, there must be a perfect love, a perfect goodness, and a perfect truth that corresponds to the desires of our heart. And that would be God. And the purpose of Christianity is to bring God and us together. That's what the incarnation is about, right? You have God and you have humanity, and they're joined in the person of Jesus, who's both true God and true human being. Both. Not half and half. Fully God, fully man. Both. And when we're incorporated into the body of Christ, we have a sharing in that. When we become part of Christ's body, we get a share in his divinity. We realize the dream of Adam and Eve. Right? They wanted to become divine. Right? You guys know that classic story, right? They were told not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And you might have always wondered, like, what the hell is that about? Why does God make such a random thing about trees and not? What's going on here? Right? Well, if I say to you, I know this campus from one side of the campus to the other, I'd be saying to you, well, I have full knowledge of the campus. If I say to you, I know the philosophy of Thomas Aquinas from A to Z, right? I'd be saying, I have complete knowledge of the philosophy of Thomas Aquinas. So to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, all the way from one extreme of goodness all the way to the other extreme of evil, is to say complete and total knowledge. That is to say, divine knowledge. But divine knowledge isn't just a knowledge it receives from the outside. It's not like my knowledge where I look at you and say, oh, you're wearing a shirt that says encounter something more. Right? So I receive that passively. God's knowledge is different. God's knowledge is a creative knowledge. Right? God's knowledge thinks a thought, let there be light, and there's light. Right? It's a creative kind of knowledge. So for Adam and Eve to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is for Adam and Eve to try to become, by their own power, God. And the atheistic philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre once said that man is the desire to be God. The idea is that all of us want to be God. Why? Because all of us like to, in effect, replace God. Say, well, yes, I know God, you have these expectations for me. I know that you tell me not to do this and to do this and whatever, but I want to be in charge. I know better than you do anyway. Right? And isn't that the nature of every sin? They say, well, I'm in charge. I don't care what you say. I'm going to do what I want. Tough luck for you, God. Tough luck for my neighbor. Right? So, positive psychology can't give us God. And therefore, can't give us the kind of happiness that our hearts crave. So, if everything I've said so far is right, why aren't all Christians super happy? Have you guys ever met an unhappy Christian? Raise your hand. Anyone you know who said is Christian, practices, whatever, and they're unhappy? Yeah, I know people like that too. So how do you explain that? Well, I think there's actually some pretty good explanations for that. The first explanation comes from positive psychology itself. One of the things they found in positive psychology is that part of our happiness has to do with our genetic makeup. So if you think about your health, are you a healthy person or are you a sickly person? You get sick all the time or are you basically healthy? Part of that is your genetics. Some people are just born with bad lungs, say. And they get colds and whatever. And they...
I've
okay, very unhealthy. Okay, fair enough, fair enough. So, some people are born with bad health, right? And if you're born with bad health, you're not going to be able to, be as healthy as someone who's born with really good health, right? Now, the same thing's true of happiness. So think about children. You probably have seen little children at the playground, right? And some little kids in the playground are kind of upbeat, and they're really filled with joy, and they're playing with their friends, and they're really, they're kind of happy kids. And then some little kids in the playground are going to be not so like that, right? So part of us, they think about half of our happiness level is genetic. So there will be some people who are practicing Christians who just got born with an unfortunate genetic mix, and so they're just not as happy as other people.
Right.
Secondly, if happiness is in part based on our activities, in particular our activities of loving God and neighbor, right, to the degree that we don't do that, we're going to make ourselves less happy. And isn't it true that some Christians don't practice their faith very well? They don't take Jesus' advice. They don't forgive others. They don't serve others. They don't love God with their whole heart and their neighbor as themselves. So they'd be a little bit like someone who goes to the divine physician and gets, medications. Yeah, take, this pill in the morning and do this inhaler at night and you get all these medications. They go, well, thanks for the great advice, doctor. That's wonderful. And then you go home and you open up the mirror and you put it behind the mirror and that's it. You never take the medication. Well, if you never take the medication, of course you're not going to get better, right? So if Christ the physician gives us medications, gives us prescriptions, well, they don't do us any good unless we follow up on them. We take the medication, for example, right? But isn't it true that some people who call themselves Christians aren't taking the advice of the divine physician? And so if they don't take the advice of the divine physician to that very degree, they're not going to be as healthy and happy as they otherwise would be. A third thing is that whether you're Christian, Jewish, atheist, Muslim, agnostic, it doesn't matter. Your happiness in part has to do with your physical well-being. So, whatever your religious beliefs, if you get run over by a car and you're in the road, both legs are broken, you're going to be less happy than you would be if you were just fine and healthy. Right? Obviously. Right? And being Christian, right, does not make you invulnerable to physical health problems. Right? Cars run over Christians just as well as atheists and Jews and whatever. It doesn't matter, right? The same thing is true, actually, of mental health. Right? You can get depressed regardless of your religious faith. You can be anxious regardless of your religious faith. Now, it does turn out that the rate of depression and the rates of anxiety for people of faith that practice their faith are lower than people that don't. But still, lower is not non-existent, right? So some Christians are less happy than they otherwise would because they have physical health problems or mental health problems. So that's going to lower your happiness, right? Now, in particular, I want to focus on what we can't control. So if you think about why do people move away from love, right? You can think of the love of God a little bit like a campfire or something, right? So you're out at night around the campfire. And if you're right by the fire, right, very warm and very bright. But if you move away from the fire, and you choose to move further and further away from the fire, and disconnect yourself from the fire, well, what happens? The further away you move, it gets colder, it gets darker, and if you keep on moving away from the fire, eventually you won't even see the fire, and you're going to be really cold, and it's going to be really dark, right? And likewise, you can move towards the flame, right? As you move towards the flame, it gets hotter, and it gets brighter, and hotter and brighter the closer you go. So our happiness is to a degree under our control. If God is perfect goodness, perfect truth, and perfect love, to the degree we get closer to God, we're going to be warmer, we're going to be lighter, we're going to feel the effects of that. And that's under our control. So that's one way, a kind of analogy for thinking about people that are advancing in the spiritual life or retreating in the spiritual life, right? Getting closer or further away from God. Now, what causes people to move further away from God? Well, Aquinas thought there were three things. Ignorance, malice, and weakness of will. So ignorance would be, I had no idea that was wrong. I had no idea where the fire was. I just, out of pure not knowing, moved in the wrong direction. And for most people, I guess, and I'm guessing in this room, that's not the reason you move away from the flame, the fire of God's love. It's not because you have no idea, lying was wrong or something, or no idea being rude was wrong, right? Second reason is malice. And malice is when someone says, I know this is wrong. I know this offends God. I know this violates the love of neighbor, but to hell with it. I'm going to do it anyway. That's something like Milton's Satan in Paradise Lost, where he says, evil, be thou my good. Right, that's malice. Now, maybe you guys are malicious people. I doubt it. Seem like pretty good people. Probably don't do things wrong because of that. So why do people do things wrong, typically? It's usually not ignorance. They knew it was wrong. It's usually not malice. Like, I could care less about God. I can do whatever I want. It's usually weakness of will. What that means is you have good intentions. You want to do the right thing. And then you get in the moment and, oh, geez, oh, one thing leads to another. Oh, shoot, and then you go the wrong way. Right? That's weakness of will. Right? Weakness of will is like people that start their diet on January 1st, and then they get to 2nd, 3rd, and by January 8th, they're like, oh, I can't do it. Right? Or like some people with lunch. Right? Ash Wednesday, they're like, oh, I'm doing this stuff. Woo, trying to be great. And they get in there and it's like, oh, geez, no. If that happens to you, by the way, just get back on the horse. You know, that's all right. If you fall off the horse, just get back on. Anyway, so as I conclude, what I want to talk about are some ways that secular psychology has talked about to strengthen willpower. Right? To strengthen willpower. And if we use our will to try to increase with love of God and love of neighbor, then the more willpower we have, the happier we're going to be able to be. Okay, so how do we strengthen willpower? Well, the secular psychologists have looked into this quite a bit, and one of the things they noticed is that our willpower is a little bit like our muscle power. And that's to say that our strength can be depleted, right? And so, if you have a willpower struggle, for instance, it's best to do whatever you're trying to do earlier in the day rather than later. Because most people throughout the day get more and more tired, and so at the end of the day, they're just wiped out, and it's hard for them to do. So, for instance, let's say you want to pray more. It's almost certainly a good idea to do it early in the day rather than later, right? So let's say you get up at 8:30. Yeah, and go get a little breakfast, maybe pray from 9 to 9:30, 9 to 9:15. And if you're not praying every day, that is not a good situation. Why? Because prayer is essential for love of God. It's absolutely essential. I mean, I love my wife. And if you say, hey, when's the last time you talked to your wife? I'm like, oh, you know, I talk to my wife every Christmas and Easter. I make sure I go there and I talk to her and say, I catch up for a whole hour. Say, honey, how you doing? And that's it. Just Christmas and Easter. Well, if I did that, you say, well, you don't really love your wife at all. How did you say you love your wife and talk to her twice a year? Right? If we love someone, we talk to them frequently. In fact, aren't people that are in love with each other, don't they talk to each other constantly? Right? So, if we want more love of God, we have to communicate with God. We have to pray. We have to make time for God. Just like we make time for friends. Right? I mean, if I ask you about your best friend, how often do you talk to your best friend? I'm guessing you talk to the person really often. And you get together, and you do stuff together. Well, the same thing's true for relationship with God. So, the willpower experts say, if you want to do something that requires willpower, do it earlier in the morning. Another thing they found is that we can weaken our own willpower through, for instance, eating a bunch of junky bad food. Right? That weakens our willpower. Another thing that weakens our willpower is not getting enough sleep. Right? If you're staying up till 3 in the morning, checking your Instagram or whatever, well, you can do that, of course, but in doing that, you're going to weaken your willpower. Right? Another thing they found that weakens willpower, and this is no big surprise, is alcohol. Right? Alcohol is going to lower your willpower. Right? So if you want to have more willpower, how about less alcohol or no alcohol? Right? That's going to strengthen your willpower. Right? Willpower is like a muscle. And how do we strengthen our muscles? Well, we strengthen our muscles through exercise. Right? If you want to get in better shape, what should you do? Well, maybe go running, maybe go swimming, get on a bike. You want to do something to exercise your muscles, and if you do that, you're going to get stronger and stronger. So willpower is akin to a muscle, and we strengthen our muscles and willpower how? Through exercising them. So what does that mean? Well, what that means is we can gain greater willpower if we exercise our willpower through doing things to strengthen them. So the secular psychologists give the example of sitting up straight, standing up straight, or speaking without swearing. Here are some other examples. You could put no butter on your bread, right? You can only put one thing of sugar in your coffee rather than two. You could have only one or two cups of coffee rather than three or four, right? These are all things you could do. At a meal, you could decide, well, I'm going to eat whatever part of the meal I like least first, right? So for me, that's always salad. Eat the salad first, eat the steak later, right? So we're not talking about crazy things like, I want you to get up at 4 in the morning, take an ice cold shower, and then I want you to, you know, pray for 3 hours straight. I mean, it's not this crazy stuff that's just like, you know, super hard. This is very, you know, reasonable, moderate things. And guess what? We have a whole season called Lent dedicated to doing this kind of thing. Right? Lent is about what? Prayer, fasting, and almsgiving. Right? So prayer we've talked about already, making time for God. Right? And again, 15 minutes a day. You guys are adults. That's minimum. You can't have a relationship with God if you don't pray. Have to pray. Have to. I mean, if you want to have more love of God, that is. If you want to have a relationship with God. If you want a relationship with God, prayer is absolutely. So prayer, fasting, what's that? That's what I'm talking about. Mortification. That is giving something up. And as adults, you guys are able to give up more than you did as little children. Right? Little children have little children, you know, ones and things. Right? Like, well, what did you give up, Johnny? Well, I didn't give up, like, all Skittles. I gave up eating the red Skittles. I eat the rest. All right, well, that's great for, like, a seven-year-old. That's terrific, right? You still eat Skittles, you just don't eat the red Skittles, which you didn't like anyway. Great. That's great for a little child, right? But you guys aren't little children. You're adults, right? So what's an adult Lent? What does that look like? Well, here's an idea. I'll just throw some things out there. What if you said the rosary every day? That's more of an adult thing. What if you gave up alcohol all Lent? That's an adult Lent. What if you got up and didn't use Facebook or Instagram all Lent? Or maybe every most of Lent, on Sundays you went on social media, but the rest of it you gave up. Right? That's an adult, right? What if you, well, here's something Mother Teresa did. Mother Teresa, not just during Lent, her whole life, she only drank water, her whole life. Right? Not just no alcohol, no juice, no milk, no, just water. Well, that's an adult Lent that she did for her whole life. That obviously has nothing to do with it. It's a little tough. Yeah, prayer, fasting, almsgiving. What does that mean? Well, almsgiving can be giving money, right? And if you're like, I was in college, you didn't have much money. So almsgiving, in a broader sense, isn't just money. It's giving to those in need. And it can be giving your time, giving your service. How about this? Do you have an old grandma who's a widow? Grandpa's dead. She's by herself now. What if you called her every Sunday? What if you visited her, made time for her, just to catch up? I bet she'd love that. Right? I know she'd love that. Almost nothing do grandmothers like more than their grandchildren. Right? Almost nothing, right? You can make your life a lot better. That's a beautiful way of giving alms. Right? Doesn't cost anything except for your time. And your attention, and your love. Beautiful, beautiful thing. So the secular psychologists warn us that we can never have perfect willpower, but they also say we can increase our willpower, we can get better. And this is a good, healthy, realistic way of thinking about things. If we want heaven on earth, that's never going to happen. We're never going to be absolutely perfect, right? But can we get better? Yeah, we can do that, right? I'm never going to be a perfect father. Could I be a better father? Yeah, I can try to do that. I'm never going to be a perfect husband. Could I be a better husband? Yeah, I can manage that. Could I be a better friend? Yeah. Could I be a better Catholic? Yeah. Right? So to move forward, and that's what this whole season of Lent is about. Lent comes from word meaning growth. Right? And we want to grow during Lent. We want to grow closer to the fire and the warmth and the heat and the light of the love of God. That's what we're going to do. And as long as we're here on earth, we're never going to be perfect. But we're not going to be here on earth forever. We don't know when we're going to leave this earth. You probably got 60 years left. 70. I don't have that long. But maybe that's wrong. I mean, who knows? This might be our last one. What would you do if you knew this was your last one? I take it seriously. Right? In any case, sooner or later, we'll be face to face with God. And He will not care about our money. He's not going to care about our fame. He's not going to care how many friends we have on Facebook or Instagram. None of that's going to matter. The only thing that's going to matter is love. Right? How much do we love God? How much do we love neighbor? That is going to matter. And hopefully we'll be very pleasing to say.